Okay, looks like we can start. All right, good morning. Thanks for coming. Wow, I even got an answer. I was expecting very little, given it's the morning after the party and all that, and we are in Vegas. So my name is Pablo Castro. I'm an architect on the OData team at Microsoft. And what I wanted to talk about in this session is what you can expect to see in the near future coming to OData or the Open Data Protocol. Two caveats to keep in mind in this talk. First, OData at this point is pretty much a community effort. A lot of the design decisions we make them across multiple companies, multiple organizations. Most of the discussion happens in the mailing list that sits in odata.org. So what you'll see here is kind of the trends that are, you know, that come out of the discussion on that list. But this is a pretty dynamic thing, and so you can expect more change to happen. Second, I'm going to focus for the most part on the protocol itself. So this is the features that make up the protocol, and not so much on specific frameworks. I will, of course, do demos and stuff over particular frameworks, but this is a talk about the protocol, and you can expect the various frameworks to keep up with the protocol as we do at different speeds there. Some of them are built by us, and we kind of know how schedules look like, and some are we are not involved in, so they run at their own pace. So let me start by setting a little bit of context on, like, I want to frame how we think about adding features and when we resist it, when we think it's a good idea, and what features we think are interesting. So why is OData interesting? Why does it work? There's a few things that make OData useful, and not a lot of it has to do with, you know, of course it doesn't, it has to not suck, but other than that, the technical details have to be, you know, only not very bad ideas. There's other aspects that are not directly related to technical details that also are important. One of them is the fact that it's a uniform interface. Lots of people agree on the same one. So you can have multiple independent parties exposing and consuming data, and the thing kind of just works. There's relatively little friction to make data flow between systems. The other one is that although we keep the protocol as simple as possible, we want implementations to be already there, so you don't have to go build from scratch a particular server or client and then have to deal with all the common mistakes, spend a bunch of time doing something that is not your core business, and so on. And finally, we want to keep the thing really simple. This doesn't mean that there aren't parts of the protocol that are relatively sophisticated. What it means is if the task is simple, the process to achieve the task needs to be simple as well. You see all these demos that we do where sometimes we do these three lines of maybe JavaScript and within jQuery or something, and the thing just works. So it's important for us to preserve that because it means that when you have a simple scenario, there is no complexity getting in the way. And then, you know, as the requirements get fancier, then we have sophisticated features in some areas to accommodate those. So the other thing that is interesting in the context of extending the protocol with new features is how are people using it. If you look at all the customers and the questions we get and the discussions we have when we learn about what they do, you can kind of cluster them in three main groups. One is the group of folks that are building kind of modern applications that are no longer targeting a single client surface area. These applications have a web presence, but also they have to target a number of devices like, you know, phones and slates and tablets and PCs. So very quickly you realize that for all of these types of applications, what you end up designing first is a web API. And then on top of the API, you build multiple client projections. You build, you know, a phone story, you build a slate story, you build a website, and so on. And you can, of course, for a web API, you can always just create a custom API. The thing with a custom API is that you have to basically go through all the same mistakes we made, and, you know, we documented most of our bad ideas, so you can walk through them, but it's probably a good idea to just pick up something that, you know, it's been out there for a while. It's, you know, we already screwed up a number of times and fixed it, there's a bunch of experience on how to use it. And also, the nice thing about an API that is not custom is that then you can pick up the clients for all these environments and be ready to go. You don't have to write clients, or your customers, your users don't have to write custom code. The other group of users that we see are folks that want to do data publishing. This is institutions like government organizations or catalogs or things like that that are very focused on data publishing. They tend to be read-only. They tend to have very large volumes of data, and they want to publish out there either for free, like in the case of government institutions, or as part of a business as a business proposal, like, for example, the data market product that we have at Microsoft. And finally, we also see a lot of our data hidden inside kind of more traditional Ajax or Silverlight applications, where all data is the channel between the front end and the back end. And one thing we see there is many of the successful applications that start there end up in the first bucket, because the application becomes very successful, and this is one of many front ends that you end up wanting. Like, you know, these interesting apps, sooner or later people want to get at the data, but they want to do it in Excel or in some analytics tool like Tableau, or they want to do reporting on the data, or they want to create a phone experience, and maybe they want to do a native application. So we see a lot of applications that start in the last category and then kind of move to the web API bucket. So that's some framing on how we think about the protocol and how we think about the users of the protocol. With that in mind, the way I'm going to articulate the roadmap is I'm going to slice it in three angles: functionality, efficiency, and extensibility. And let me hit functionality first. We have a number of ways of tracking what users want, and some of it is we just get hate email, so you know that's a way of doing it. The other one is we have in the User Voice website, we have a page where people can vote, and also we do events and things like this where we chat with people. And so there is two features that are kind of number, I think, 1 and 3 in pretty much all of these lists that we wanted to take on first, so I want to discuss those. One is better queries, and the other one is actual support for inheritance instead of the kind of lame-ish support that we have today. What happened on the query side is there is a class of queries that is basically not possible to formulate today, and it turns out that it's very common. Queries is a tricky area. There is a lot of work over 30, 40 years in the space of query processing, query languages, and so on. So it's not like we have to invent stuff. The problem is choosing what things do we want to incorporate in the protocol and tax every server out there with supporting it. So we're very careful about the nature and complexity of what we introduce and what is the payoff? Like, how much are we going to get out of increasing the surface area? So after a lot of debate, we decided to introduce two operators, any and all, that they're very similar, that hugely expand the classes of queries you can create without increasing the surface area too much. This is small change in the protocol, high yield, and I'm going to drill into the details in a minute. The other request, this is one number one request pretty much across the board, is we use the underlying data modeling that OData uses supports inheritance, structural inheritance. There's no behavior involved. It's more like specialization where you have extra properties. The problem is that so far we didn't support navigation properties or associations between the subtypes, and that really makes it difficult to apply inheritance in certain scenarios. So we've been working on enabling this particular scenario as well. This not only means you can use inheritance now better in OData, but it also means if you are in the Microsoft stack and you're using WCF data services and the input model is an entity framework model, then you can pretty much take any model and use it. Before, all the models that used inheritance extensively couldn't be used. For those that use OData but don't use the entity framework, then that's not so much of a problem, but lack of inheritance in general was a problem. So let me drill into these two and talk about what, after a long set of discussions, where we landed on. So let me start with any and all. Any and all are things that go into filters. And so let's imagine a schema like this. This is a subset of the mix. The mix conference data itself is exposed as OData. It's at live.visitmix.com/OData. So this is just a little slice of that schema. It has tags and sessions with a many-to-many relationship. Sessions there is a navigation property. And then session has a collection of speakers, because sometimes you have more than one, so you can't assume a single one. So speakers is a navigation property, again, and the cardinality of that is one to many. Although it could be many to many now that I think about it. So this is a pretty simple question. We have a lot of famous Scotts. So what if you want any session where the name of the dude is Scott? Turns out that you can't ask this question today. Think about it in terms of the current language. You could try to write something like this, which the server will fail on you on. And the first problem is, what's that? Like, speakers is a collection. So you, what does it mean to go slash first name? Well, is it the first name of the first entry in the collection? Is it kind of some sort of union? It just doesn't make any sense. And then the equals operator also doesn't cut it, because equals to what? The collection to a singleton? Like, there's an expressiveness gap. And this is actually, the class of queries is very common because you have one-to-many relationships and you want to ask questions about that to see if this one item actually fits the criteria or not. So the way we're modeling this is we're introducing any. And what you can do is, if you have a navigation property that lands on a collection, then you can use the any operator. So you go navigation property slash any, and then the body inside the any introduces a new iteration variable that is in the context of every individual entry on the outer collection. So now we're back where we can use our regular scalar operators to work on this. So now I can simply say the iteration variable, I just called it s. You can basically bind the variable to any name you want. And then slash first name, which is the actual property, equals Scott. Now the operator makes sense, and the query kind of now all is, the grammar kind of hangs together. So these operators also nest. You can nest them to ask kind of questions that go deep or combine them and things like that. So for example, let's say you wanted to see all the speakers that had sessions tagged with OData. So you want speakers that are really committed to OData and not talking about something else. So you can do something like this, where what you say is, of the sessions is a navigation property on speaker. I want all of them such that the tags collection has at least one of them being OData. So this is a typical, the tags question is very common. Many things have tags, and you often want to ask questions in terms of the tags. Do I have something that has this or that tag? So this allows you to do that, and you can see how these operators can nest, like in this example I'm doing on all of these and any of that. And the semantics of it is all means every item on the collection I'm testing matches the criteria. The anyone says if at least one of them does, then that's fine. In the limit, you can choose to have not criteria at all, so have just open, close parent. And what that means is if I have any at all. So it's the same as saying, you know, it's saying the true constant inside the body of the operator. So this is one. So the other one is inheritance. The missing piece in inheritance was navigation properties in subtypes. So imagine this is not the actual scheme of mix, but let's say that the way it was organized is there is a single extent called people that has instances that are attendees, instances that are speakers, and instances that are staff, and they're all inheriting from a base type person. So in this case, person has a name, speaker has a name, but also has a collection of sessions. How do you ask the question of what are all the sessions for speaker with ID 123? You kind of, actually it's possible to ask this backwards, but nobody wants to think that way. You want to kind of think the way you want to write the query the way you think about it. So you could, I mean, the first intuition is to go do that. Say, well, I have a person, I look up the ID, and then go slash sessions. Especially for those familiar with OData, this is kind of the natural way of writing this. Except this gives an error, because the URL, as processed by the server, is effectively treated as a little strongly typed language where, semantics have to validate at compile time. So people is a set where each item is of type person. So the type person doesn't have a session's navigation property. So the URL translator simply says, look, I can't guarantee that this URL makes sense, so I'm not gonna let you run it. In fact, if the person wasn't of type speaker, not only would we have a runtime error, but also we wouldn't know until we actually retrieve the entity from the back end and all that. So the way we're doing this is we introduced a new kind of operator. It's a new thing you can put anywhere where there is a segment, where there is a path. And this segment basically lets you state that you know better what the type of the thing is. This is the way you would formulate that particular question. And the way you read that is slash people is the set of all the people, so all the instances of person or any subtype. When you add the segment slash mix.speaker, mix is the namespace there of the type, what you're saying is I want to change the type of the iteration variable into speaker. That not only changes the type, but also means that anything that was not a speaker needs to be excluded from there. So you only end up with speakers or instances of a subtype of speaker. And then the rest of the URL semantics apply. So I can use the parentheses to look up a single one. And since now the iteration variable there is of type speaker, then I can say slash sessions, and that works. So this works anywhere where you can put where you can tack on a segment on a path. So not only works there, I showed it in the path part of the URL. You can also do it without a lookup. And then once you did this, you end up with a set of speakers, which means all your filters and sorting and in general, all the query options are in terms of speaker and not in terms of person anymore. So you get to use the details of this particular type. You can also use it after the question mark in expand, select, and all these things that take paths. Like, for example, here, what I'm saying is, actually, I want all the people. Now, for each one, if it happens to be a speaker, then also expand the sessions. It is not an error to also have in the result things that are not speaker. In that case, the kind of the session expansion will sort of null propagate into being empty, so we will not put the link. Same thing applies to projection. So you can project in the sessions, and what that means is if we can actually project it, we'll do. If not, then it will simply not be there. So this alone actually should increase the kind of the overall expressiveness of the query language quite a bit without taxing clients and servers a lot. It's a funny story about this one. The need for this was pretty clear, so the way we usually do this is somebody, sometimes on Microsoft, sometimes outside, does an initial write-up and says, well, here's how we should solve this problem, and you send it to the mailing list and discuss. So somebody in our team did, and we worked on it for a while, and there's always the question of what symbol are you going to use to introduce a new operator? So you look at the keyboard, we're running out of symbols, so we picked bang, like the exclamation mark. And we baked on that for a while, and we were all happy with it, and then we said, okay, let's send it so everybody else can take a look and see if it's looking good. And everybody else was immediately like, do you realize that bangs means not almost for everybody? So we didn't catch that at all until we were sharing this publicly, so we had to kind of go rehash, and that's where we landed on the segment syntax. Slash was just a much more natural thing than having an exclamation mark that would mean not for kind of half the world. Another functionality thing that we've been discussing lately and we want to get right is geospatial. If you look at the applications that you carry on your phone, for example, a lot of them make use of location information. And they also interact with services that have geospatial information. And so we think this is too core of a characteristic to be tacked on top of the protocol. We think it's a core part of the protocol, to the point that we think of geospatial information as part of the primitive type system. Just like we have ints and strings, we think we need some sort of representation for geospatial information. The way we are approaching this is we think what we need is a way of representing the data. Sometimes you can do latitude and longitude in two columns, but that only takes you so far. There is lack of expressiveness, like you don't know which coordinate system you're using. There is many cases where what you need is not a point, it's something else. So we're thinking we'll do data types for typical things like points and polygons and things like that, and represent them somehow, either by introducing a type or a family of types or something along those lines. Then once you have the data that you can represent in your schema, then you want to be able to ask questions about it. Like, if you think about what you do with your phone about this, you do things like you're saying, I need like a coffee shop that is within a mile of where I am. So it's kind of a distance query. Or sometimes you have a map in your phone, and you know the viewport of the map. And what you want to say is, give me any coffee shop that fits in my rectangle, in my viewport. So it's kind of an intersection question. Or there's other things like, I want to know which zip code am I at, or I want to intersect my coverage, my cell phone coverage area with my zip code or something. So mostly point, distance, area intersection kind of things. The good thing is there's no need to invent stuff here. It's just a matter of making choices. There is extensive work in this area already in the data type space as well as in the, there's standardization that already happened around query operations. So it's a matter of, just like I said, mentioned before, making the right choice to balance the overall tax we're introducing for all clients and servers and getting the functionality that people need to write these types of applications. This in particular, with so many people using OData for phones and mobile devices in general, seems to be very important. Finally, there's a wire representation question. You request a feed that has ints and strings that's easy to decide. Once it has geospatial information, well, how you represent that? And we're actively debating this. There's things like GeoJSON there's things like well-known text and well-known binary. So there is a lot to work that already happened. So it's mostly a matter of making sure we understand the problem space well and making the making the choices there. So you can expect more about this soon. We're like, for those of you that are interested in the OData mailing list, we're having actually quite a bit of discussion about this right now. All right, so that was a quick pass over functionality. There's one or two more items. I'll leave them. I'll mention them at the end in case you're interested in them. But let me push forward and talk about efficiency. Obviously, efficiency is a big deal. Nobody likes slow applications, and nobody likes to pay more for resources to run those applications. Now, the tricky thing is how to do efficiency and stay interoperable. You can always one-off a bunch of stuff and tweak until your closed system goes real fast. Now, the trick is, can we do this and still retain the interoperability and the low barrier of entry that we have today? So that's what kind of has at least me nervous about landing efficiency the right way. We need to find the balance between the two. So there is, when you think about efficiency, many aspects of efficiency have to do with the actual implementations. But there's certainly things we can do at the protocol level to help with that. Very naively speaking, there's two things we can do that should help right away. One is give you more means to ship less data around. Things like selection, filtering, and projection, and all those are basically designed to allow you to kind of narrow down the data that you exchange exactly to the point that you need. And we are doing more in that space. The other one is, if you have to move data around, do it at a minimum cost. So watch the bloat on the payloads, watch the overhead of the syntax you're using to transport, and so on. So let me drill on two features we're working that should help with these areas. One of them has to do with refreshing data. Again, if you look at all the applications on your phone, a lot of them follow this pattern that is pretty consistent. On first run, or embedded as part of the app itself, they'll contain a data set, either your weather information, your list of cities, a list of movies, something. And so it lands on your phone, and then what you do from that point on is you refresh that data set. So you want the changes since the last time. And it's kind of a reference data thing for the most part right now. Like, some changes sometimes go back, but mostly it's pull the changes down. So even though it mostly happens on the phones, you can imagine the same thing happening on desktops or even server scenarios. Like, for example, imagine you have a subscription to Data Market. Data Market is our offering where you can go buy data sets that from data providers. And they don't do this today, and I actually don't know if they're planning on doing it, but you can imagine if there's a type of subscription that allows you to cache the data, then you can take the download hit once, and then every time you need a refresh, you just refresh it. You don't download a giant data set every time, so you can keep it up to date at little cost. So the question is, how we do that, how we do all this in a way that is natural to our data and strictly incremental from what we have today. We don't want to go reboot a bunch. Like, we want to take all everything we have today and do a few tweaks and enable this scenario. So this is what it's looking like right now. So if you do a get on something like some collection in your service, today what you get is something like this. You get a field, and the field has a bunch of entries inside. So we want to keep this just as is. And what we want to do is we want to enable servers to choose whether any particular set or collection or particular query can support this refresh contract. And if it can, then the server gets to tell you that. And the way it does is it can include a new link at the bottom of the field or at the top, outside the entries, that has a special rel of called delta. This is the delta link. And the href is some URL that is opaque. You're not supposed to peek inside the thing. The contract is pretty simple. If that thing is not there, the server doesn't do it. If it is there, then if you pull from that URL, you'll get the changes since the time you got the URL. That's it. So the idea is, you get the first time, you'll probably get it with a delta link. You do another get later because you want to kind of refresh your local data set, and what you'll get is new entries. And the way you merge them is, if you actually see an entry, it's either new or it's updated. And since every entry has an ID, you have to go look it up locally. If it is there, then you just overwrite all the values. If it is not there, then you add it. Of course, you're missing how to delete things. So in the Atom case, it was very handy. The Atom community had already introduced a way of marking deleted entries. So in the original feed, you're not going to get this. But in a Delta feed, you will get deleted entries as well. And we'll give you the ID, so you go locate it and just remove it from your collection. The nice thing about this approach, or the nice things about this approach, is first, it leaves the server in control. The server can choose what to encode in the URL, what is the refresh policy, where does it go. You can even do, you know, the traditional way of doing this would be if you have a database, maybe you encode some, you know, high watermark, like a timestamp or something, and then you do a greater than later. And that could be a way of doing it. But you can also do, let's say you update once a day, every day at 3 a.m. Well, you can actually cache everything and have the URLs be fixed. So clients will simply follow the URLs during the day, probably never costing you work. And then you just set the expiration of everything at 3 a.m. and just HTTP will do its expiration thing for caching. And then next time around a client comes, pulls the URL, then you get the next day's version. So by using these well-known principles around, you know, letting the server drive and having kind of link-based interactions, is the kind of the hypermedia thing in the RESTful approach, then this allows us to give server control and have the clients have a known interaction model without having to know too much about how the server is going to do it. So it's very, very powerful with very little surface area. The other thing that is interesting is if you don't care about this, then the only thing you need to do is not choke on the link. Like, if you just do a GET on a server that happens to be Delta enabled, you'll get a regular field perfectly compatible with Astoria or with all data because the initial feed doesn't have deletes or anything. And all you'll see is a custom link, which is the Delta link, you just ignore. So we can introduce this on the existing servers. You don't need a new entry point. You don't need a different version. You don't need to change anything. It's just strictly incremental from what we have today. So, of course, I showed the Atom version of this. This is the JSON version of it. In JSON, we have to be a little bit more creative because there's no namespaces. So you can see here how the regular curly braces rows are regular rows in the result. And then the deleted there is an example of a deletion marker. And then the Delta link comes at the bottom. Same contract. If you don't know about Delta, just ignore it. In fact, existing clients will not choke on it. They'll just ignore the link. So let me show you a little bit of this in practice. Actually, can you do me a favor? Those of you that have phones and laptops, just tweet some whatever random appropriate tweet to. So this is our session hash code, FRM11. No need to get too fancy, but if you have a few, that'd be handy. So let me show you a couple of things now. So you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but there is, if you go to live.visitmix.com/odata, there is an odata service there. We have a service that is a clone of it called Mix with Tweets. cloudapp.net/odata. And so this guy is basically a clone of the other service, except this one has an extra collection that is Delta enabled. And this collection is a tweets collection. So for every session, we have a worker that is just watching Twitter, and for each session is pulling all the tweets for that session. So you can see that in addition to sessions, we have tweets here. So the idea is, if I go and get, let's get sessions, I'm going to get a regular feed. That feed is not kind of Delta enabled, so I'll get a plain feed. Let's see if this comes up. Let's do this in parallel. On the other hand, if I actually go to the tweets one, come on. There. So this is the sessions one. And if I go to the end, I see a regular, this is a next page thing. So this is regular server-driven paging, but this is a regular feed. If I go to the tweets one, I can see a bunch of tweets. Wow, you guys are working. And then at the bottom, I can see the Delta link, and this is some URL that encodes whatever it needs to encode so we can continue this later. So let me grab this URL. I'm going to just copy-paste it here. And, you're going too fast. Hold on. So let's see if I can catch up. There. So I caught up. Now, if you keep tweeting, then what's going to happen is now there's empty because I kind of follow the refresh, and I caught up. And eventually, see, somebody else, hi back. So somebody has tweeted something, and now like we're seeing only that change. And of course, if you see this URL and this, these are different because since we caught up with more, now we give you a new Delta link, and then you just keep going like that. So how do you use this? Is let me show you two examples. First one, let me do something in JavaScript. So I have a web page here. I already wrote it, so you don't have to watch me write kind of boilerplate JavaScript code. So this is what it does is it lists all the sessions that are tagged with OData, and then when you click on a session, it just lists all the tweets for that session. And I don't have time to scan all, so I'm going to switch out in case there is something dangerous there. So let's say I want to write this in. What I want to do is I want to cache the tweets locally. And first time, I'm going to download them all. Next time, I'm going to download them all again, because let's say I'm starting without Delta support and merge them with the local ones. And you can imagine doing this in order to very quickly show the first content and then just show what changed since then. So let's walk through the code real quick. So first part is just get the list of sessions, very vanilla jQuery foo. And then there is the list tweets method that gets called every time you click on one. And what it does is there is a cache of tweets, and we have the URL hard-coded for the list of tweets for each session, or for the session pattern. And if we do find it in the cache, then we render before we request. That means that we render right away, and then we send the request, and when it comes back, we render the updated version. So it kind of gives you more interactivity and hides the latency of the page a little bit. So then we call getJSON. When we get the response, we merge the tweets with the ones we already had, and render them. And render the tweets is just this, it's a very small loop that renders stuff. The merge code doesn't really do anything interesting. It finds the entry in the cache, and if we didn't find it, we create a new one. Otherwise, we use the one we want and bring in all the entities that we already had. Note that I'm merging on the ID. The idea is you can have things come back that you already had, especially here because I'm not using deltas. So I'm just saying, I'm looking it up. If I don't find it, I'll just go add it. So let's say I want to delta enable this. So whenever I click on something, the thing doesn't keep retrieving everything. If I do it now, let me just turn this on. Every time I click on one of these, the browser is using the regular URL. Let me click on another one so we can see. So this is the same. This is base URL I hard coded. Just the only thing that's changing is the session ID. So let's go back here and make a few changes. So first change is in my cache, I'm going to store the delta. I know the delta link is coming on this one, so I'm going to store it in the object I keep in my cache. So this is going to be data.d.underscore_delta. Remember the JSON payload I had in the example. So that's first thing. So now that I have it, what I can do here is if I found an entry in the cache, then sure, I'll render it so I can come back fast. But also, I'm going to say if the delta is not undefined, so if I have a delta, basically, a delta URL, then I'm going to overwrite the URL that I had with the d.delta URL, and I need to add a JSONP, format equals JSON, so I can actually get the callback in JSON. I'm going cross-domain, so I have to do JSONP for this. And I need to add a callback as well, so I'm going to say callback equals ? So hopefully that should do. So what this is going to do is if we found it in the cache, and if the previous response had a delta link, so this will work regardless, but if it had one, I'm going to use the delta link. So the next refresh should be much smaller. So now we're tracking it here, we're using it here. The last thing I need to do is when I merge the tweets, right now I'm just merging everything, but I need to handle deletes. So I'm going to do one more tweak here where I'm going to say if new data.t.underscore_deleted is undefined, that means it's a regular entry, so I'm going to do what I was doing. Otherwise, it means it's a deleted entry. So what I'll do is I'll remove the entry from the array. Merged new data.t. And remember that the deleted object had the ID in it, so I can actually just do that and strip out the entry from my collection. So let's see how this one runs now. I'm going to refresh this. I can see the initial retrieval of the sessions. And then if I click on one of them, I can see this is the initial URL. And I'm going to click in another one, again, initial URL. But then if I click in the first one, you can see here that This is using the URL that the server produced, and the server encoded something. In this case, our implementation encodes this delta token that basically is only the changes. So if you look inside, this response had, actually, this one is from another session nobody's tweeting about, so effectively had zero rows. It just has a new fresh delta link, but nothing else. So this is a very, very simple way of encoding this delta information in existing feeds. And you can build a client like that in a matter of minutes. Of course, like, so this is for a desktop kind of thing or a browser kind of thing. You probably want to do this in mobile devices as well. And I'll do things on Windows Phone later, but we wanted to do other devices. We have like a Mac here, and we had all sorts of jokes about this. The reality is that you don't want to watch me struggle through lack of right clicks and all that. So I want to invite Sean Pather, our developer manager and actually a skillful person on Mac things, to come and give us a demo of how to do this on an iPhone.
Thank you. So we were joking last night that the reason I'm the Mac guy is I'm the person who doesn't know anything about the Windows platform. So here I am to show you how this works. So what I have here is an app that I pre-built. So if some of you were in Mike Flasco's session in this room at 9 o'clock, I showed kind of the getting started experience with using the iOS platform and the Objective-C library to build an OData app. Here I've already built an app, and it's a kind of pre-done one. We'll release the sample code for this on the OData team blog. But really what it is basically a session browser. You can see up here it's pulled down all of the sessions. And this app uses the local core data data layer on the iOS platform to actually cache this information in a local SQLite database. So we get some of the efficiency that Pablo talked about. So this app is going against the feed with tweets. So if we click on Pablo's session here, I can get the session details. Here's the session code. But I can also hit this Twitter button. And what that's done, I've set a breakpoint in my code here, is it's going to go to the server and ask for basically all the tweets for this session. And the first time through, it's going to go through and just do a query for all the tweets. And we'll just let this run. It's going to go through and get a bunch of data. And this should fill up, there you go, with a bunch of the tweets that you all have sent. So once we've downloaded this, we actually do the same thing that Pablo's JavaScript example did, which is to store the delta link so that next time we go back, we can just get the deltas. So if you guys want to send a couple more tweets, that would be great. And what I'll do is hit this refresh button. And that's going to go and actually issue the delta query based on the link that we saw before. And assuming this comes back, it should pick up the deltas. Let's see what's going on. Let's try again.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a problem if it didn't work perfectly.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So we hit a different breakpoint here. So this one is in a method that we have that actually updates the cache. It's called refresh cache. It basically issues the delta query. And in this loop here, I get back the response from the server. And I'm able to check, is the response a deleted tweet? In this case, we're not actually deleting anything, so I'm not hitting that. Otherwise, it's an added or an updated tweet. And if I step into this method over here, what we'll just do is check whether the cache already has that tweet. And in this case, we didn't find one, because obviously it was an added tweet. So we'll just insert a new one. And we'll just let that run. Well, looks like there's a few here, so we'll just let this continue. And now when we go back to the simulator and refresh, there should be some new ones in here. They're probably at the top because it goes in reverse order. So that's basically the exact same protocol that Pablo showed. You saw it in JavaScript. Here it is working on the iOS platform.
This is great. Will people have access to this code?
Yes. So this I'm going to put this up on I'll have a link on the OData team blog, and you'll be able to go download that probably later this week.
Cool. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
All right. Okay. So let's push forward some more. So one more detail about this that I didn't talk about is paging has to interact with, deltas have to interact with paging. When you have a large data set, we don't want to have servers handle a single request for, say, 10 million rows. Sometimes you do that by requiring filtering and so on, but sometimes, even if you have a couple thousand rows, you don't want that in a single go. So usually what happens is, in a regular non-delta feed, you have a URL, and the URL kind of lands you on the first page. But then the first page contains a link to the second page that goes to the third page and so on until you eventually land on a page that has no next link. At that point, you know if you wanted to iterate the whole thing, you know you iterated the whole thing. So if the service is delta-enabled, you will only see the next link if there is a next link, if all the rows didn't fit in one response. And eventually, you'll see a delta link that you're supposed to just keep. Don't follow it on the spot, otherwise you'll just loop forever. Just keep it, and next time you want to refresh, follow the delta link, and that's going to land you on the first page of changes, not on the first page of the original field. And then it may be that the actual changes don't fit in a page, so we'll just do the same thing. We'll just give you the next links, and so you keep following. When you land on the last page that doesn't have a last link, you're caught up, at least as of when you started. And then you get another delta link. So if you want to make sure that you converged with the server, assuming you can iterate faster than the server changes the data, what you do is you can do this in a loop. Eventually, you will have one where the changes fit in a single page, and at that point, you know you're caught up with the server, at least you're consistent with the server. Of course, by the time you land the data on the client, the server might have changed, but you're consistent as of a point in time. So if you want to give it a try, we actually we took this prototype and we packaged it and we put it out there. So if you want to play with this with the Delta Link support, we put bits, and I know this is let me actually do this. I know these URLs are tricky to remember, so let me do this. I'm going to grab the URL from here and I'm going to tweet it, so you can just search for Mix or something and you should find it there. So yeah, perfect. So let me give you one last example of this, and then I'm going to move on to another topic. So how difficult is to create one of these? At the protocol level, this is about it. You can implement it any way you want. We have a implementation that uses Entity Framework and WCF data services, and this is the prototype that I just showed you that you can download and use. I'm going to just use it for an example. So what I'll do is I'll create a data service. I'm going to call it sessions, or I'm going to call it conferences. And what I'll do is I'll remove my references to system data services, and I'm going to add a reference to my tricked up versions that can handle this. I'm also going to use the new Entity Framework 4.1 that has code first support in it, just for coolness. So what I'll do here is I'm going to create a new class. I'm going to call it session. Remember, our sessions didn't have deltas, so let's have one of these. I'm going to do minimalistic here. Let's have an ID. Whoops. Dang, there. We're going to have a title. And how about start time? That should do. So now I'm going to have a class called conference data that is going to inherit from DB context. This is the pattern for what we call code first in the Entity Framework, where you don't need to do any modeling or anything. All you do is you define your classes, and then we'll create the database for you if you didn't have one, and we'll handle everything else for you. It works a lot better when you actually follow the syntax. So I'm going to have a single DB set here. It's going to be DB set of session. I meant to call this session. Call it sessions. You get it in a setter. Now, this would do for a regular Entity Framework scenario. I want to delta enable this. So what I'll do is, let me add a constructor here. In the constructor, I'm going to use a custom initializer for the database. This initializer knows about delta support. So this is the delta enabled. It's a delta enabled initializer. I'm going to give it conference data. That should do. Last step is, if you have many entities, you may not want all of them to be delta enabled, so you need to say which ones you want. You say this with the delta enabled attribute. And that's it. So now I can take conference data, put it in here. Enable, by default these services are locked down, so let's enable the sessions set. And when I hit F5, what's going to happen is on first hit, Entity Framework will figure out the schema, create a database for me, provision it. Since I use the delta enabled thing, it's going to create a delta enabled schema. And now if I access sessions, you can see, there's nothing in it because the database is brand new, but you can see I got a delta link that is going to give me the changes in this point in time. This is fully functional, it'll change track deletes and all that. We chose a default strategy for tracking changes, but you can, of course, expect that you will be able to override that on the kind of more advanced versions of the product. Right now, we're experimenting. All right. So that was deltas. Let me talk about another one. This is, I get asked so many times a day about this. So let me share where we are right now with this. Actually, I'm excited that we're finally taking on this problem. So efficiency is awesome. but you want it to be fast too. Interoperability is awesome, but you want the thing to be fast too. So the question is, we want to introduce an efficient format for data. We have two today, and they do okay. You know, people do Atom or JSON, depending on the scenario. People use HTTP compression to help with the bandwidth utilization. But we could have something. We could introduce a third format and have something that is specifically designed for efficiency. So, of course, the first question you have to ask is, okay, efficiency on what? Do you want to not use a lot of bandwidth? Do you want to be efficient in CPU utilization? Do you want to avoid burning a bunch of battery life on devices? And these things are sometimes at odds. Like, for example, a good way of saving a bunch of bandwidth is just gzip everything. In fact, HTTP supports this. It's called content encoding negotiation, where you can say gzip or deflate. But you're trading the size on the wire for CPU utilization. So that means your servers will run at a higher CPU utilization, so you'll need more servers if you have a large amount of requests. And also on the client, the trade-off is not obvious at all, because what happens with bandwidth is, like, for example, in mobile devices, once you turn on the radio, you took most of the battery hit, regardless of how many bytes you exchange, within reason, of course. So now what you have to think about is, you want to spend less time pulling things on the wire, off the wire, or you want to spend more CPU time unpacking the thing. So this is a very difficult kind of balance. And of course, you can invent 10 formats, one for each, but that's not going to cut it from the interoperability perspective. We still want an ecosystem around this. So we're exploring what to do about this. The net of it is, if we could reduce most of the redundancy of the existing formats without going for compression, without kind of taxing the CPU anymore, just reduce the redundancy, that would probably be a solid step forward. And then we can still allow people to use HTTP content encoding negotiation in order to enable compression on top if you want. But that, at that point, is not mandated, so you get to choose. So what is it that we can reduce on this thing? So this is a JSON response. I took this from the Northwind Classic database. This is actually one of the services that are an example service. And if you look at this response, first thing you have is, we have metadata. These things need to be described in terms of the type system and all that. So we have names and values. We also have URLs. These RESTful systems work really well when any one step of the system captures all the possible next actions using URLs and all the related items using URLs. The problem is, like, now you have URLs all over the place. And sometimes you can make them relative, but sometimes you can't, or sometimes you don't want to assume clients know how to reconstruct the URLs. You also have names of things. These documents are self-descriptive. You don't need out-of-band information to understand them, but that means you repeat, if you have 1,000 customers coming back on a response, you repeat each name of each property 1,000 times. And finally, you have values. That's kind of the data you actually wanted to start with, and it's embedded in all of this gunk around it. So this is what the distribution of that looks like on a number of queries. So the one on your left is a single customer. It's very similar to what we just saw. The one in the middle is bring 100 customers and expand all of its orders. So it's a very wide result set, and it's 100 rows high at the top level. It has some nested content. And the one on the far right is narrow customers. So it's 100 customers, but just a few properties. So it's the kind of thing you would do to populate like a combo box or something like that. You want it real small. I didn't plan for this, but it's the distribution of content is surprisingly consistent across them. The yellow is URLs. 40% of the payloads are URLs. The blue is names. So the blue is about 20%, between 15 and 25%. And it's what makes the payload self-descriptive, which is great. You want to avoid out-of-band knowledge, but this is what you're paying for that. And then at top, the 20-ish percent dark gray is the actual data. That's the part we want. So everything else is opportunity. So what can we do about this? So we explored a bunch of options. Some, they have nothing to do with this distribution, like EXI. EXI is a binary XML format, and as of recently, it's a recommendation of the W3C. But it's a fairly sophisticated thing to do, and it's based on XML. We also looked at things like Avro from the Apache project. We looked at protocol buffers. These are all binary formats. And even in the binary formats, we still have the problem of, like, things like URLs will still repeat, and the text will still dominate the situation regardless. So it seems there is something else we need to do. We want something that is compact, and it has the characteristics of this, but also is light on CPU. So we're still exploring. We're not, I don't think anybody has made a decision about this. I myself, I still haven't formed a strong opinion, but One thing we're exploring is this idea of, can we have a dense version of JSON? As in, can we have documents that are completely regular, legit JSON that are a dense encoding, not the kind of encoding you want to deal with, but it's one that is, you can parse with any regular JSON parser. If we were able to achieve that, then you can imagine simple clients, like maybe a browser or something, just do a JSON to JSON transform and kind of revert to the original JSON document as it is today everywhere. Fancy parsers, say on the clients we ship in, you know, .NET and Java and whatever, those can actually bypass this intermediate step and actually be very efficient. If we could manage to do something like this where we eliminate all that yellow and all that blue, all that redundancy, still maintain documents self-contained, and do it either in some binary form that is well-known or in something like JSON, that would be very powerful. So I'm going to use JSON as an example, but the strategy I'm going to describe actually applies regardless of whether we do JSON or binary or something else. So this is a dense JSON document. I'm not claiming this even works. So we did a few experiments, but there's a lot to work on. So there's two strategies that allows us to have a more density. The first one is structural templates. So this is, for those of you familiar with JSON schema, it's very much that, except that JSON schema has a lot of options. We didn't need most of them. So this simply says, I'm going to describe the self-descriptive part of the document once, or at least once per structure, and then never again. So the names of each thing only exist once. That's great because it helps with the self-descriptive part we talked about before. This is the blue. And then URLs. Actually, more in general, strings that repeat a lot, we have, in addition to structural templates, we have these textual templates. So you can see that this URL has a placeholder at the end. So the idea is, if you have something like this that the server knows, this is not a generic encoding thing, like a zip file where you take anything and zip it. This is more like a producer knowing its schema can do a lot here, because you can say, well, I know this URL is mostly consistent, mostly constant, and it has this little variability, so I'm going to just put a placeholder there and create a text template. And this is the actual data. Look how dense the data ends up being packed, because there's no description of the data. It's just arrays. And obviously, the more data you have, the better the ratios get. And this means both that there's less redundancy, so less less bandwidth utilization, but also you spend a lot less time encoding strings and put them on the wire, which means the overall CPU utilization to serialize and deserialize these which should be lower. So we're experimenting with this. Any feedback is welcome. You know, I don't think we're done yet. We need to do numbers and, you know, this is the kind of thing you want to do with hard numbers and make sure you're making the decisions based on the right input. All right. So the last topic I want to touch briefly is extensibility. All data protocol, as I said at the beginning, works well because a lot of people agree on what it is. Now, the trick here is, how do we get as many people as possible adopting the protocol and then allow them to create their own experiences on top without having to rev the protocol to add features every time? That wouldn't be a sustainable value proposition. So the way we're going to do this is we're approaching this from the extensibility perspective. And we're looking at how can we make the metadata system extensible? How do we make the queries extensible and the wire formats and the interaction model? So this is obviously a complicated problem to take on. So we started with two, and I want to drill on only one of them. We started with metadata and with actions and functions. So let me show you the metadata one by example. So let me come here. So I'm going to run an application called Sesame. That Fabrice writes. Sesame is, he's not a Microsoft person, he just writes, you know, this data browser application. And what you can do with this is you can connect, say, to the Mix website and to the OData feed, and then it you know, inspects the metadata, and you can kind of navigate the sessions and navigate the speakers and so on. And in general, it gives you this kind of generic list of things. And so typically, when you get something like this, then you don't have a lot of knowledge of the meaning of what you're looking at. All you can do is render it in a table. Now, what I did here before we started is I went to settings and registered this annotations file. So what this annotations file does is, let me show you the actual file. So this is the file. Let me see if I can actually do this. There. So don't pay any attention to the actual syntax. The idea is, what we did is we said, we're going to let you annotate anything in the schema. And annotate means you put whatever markup you want. There's no language, there's no schema. The only contract is you bring in your own namespace and then you put the annotations in. And then you get to invent what to actually do with this. Like, for example, in this example, somebody came up with this curly brace thingy syntax, and but somebody also said this is an annotation. Whoops. This is an annotation, and this is the target type that I want to hit with that annotation. And the annotation can be in line with the metadata document. You know, every OData service has a metadata document. Or it can be out of line. Like, this file was authored without talking to the mix guys. So somebody can create annotations externally to the schema or internally in the schema. And then whenever you have a tool that can process this, you can feed the tool the actual data and the annotations. And if the tool happens to recognize this particular annotation by their namespace or something, then it can do things with it. In particular, this annotation, let me just start over here. This annotation says, this session, I'm going to tell you about a calendar. And calendar is not some official thing. It's something that you agree just between one or two people. Like, it could be one-to-one. It could be within your app, or it could be the whole world. It doesn't really matter, at least not from the infrastructure perspective. The infrastructure allows you to augment your metadata with further meaning. But the meaning is up to you, and the syntax and the way you express it is up to you. Here we did two. One is we said, I'm going to describe a calendar. This is kind of saying, given any entity, if you kind of overlay this on top and you see it through these eyes, then this is going to look like a calendar entry. But this is, again, a application of this that these guys happen to come up with. It's not, I mean, the feature is just annotations. The one below is a different, it's a similar thing, except has one twist. It takes vCard. vCard is an existing kind of micro format for capturing contact information. So this one is saying speakers can be viewed as vCards by mapping this way. And it has some mapping for the names. These are all Microsoft people, although I don't think they're all Microsoft people. Here's the bio, and the address is hard-coded in this particular example. So what that means is now if an application knows about a particular, actually, I didn't mean to do that. If an application knows about a particular set of annotations, then it can use it. For example, here, you can see that when I went to sessions, actually, I had another sessions open already. I had a calendar thing there. I only had it because I added the annotation. And when I switched to calendar, in this case, you know, this application chooses to have like a calendar view or something. So the interesting thing is now you can have servers that know how to expose calendars, clients that know how to display calendars, yet there was no change to all data at all. And this can be done very locally between just one or two people, or it can be globally because the names are just URLs. This actually... Yeah, this is not invented here. There's, you know, extensive work in this space. The linked data folks have, or the semantic web rather folks, have been working on this for a long time. And all we're doing is we're kind of applying in this context. Similarly with speakers, you can see, well, I keep opening more speakers. I had one here. Speakers, same thing. Let me load some more. Again, I have a vCard view that allows me to see the speakers. And the interesting thing, again, is that it's not that it's speakers. It's if you take any... feed that has something that can kind of viewed as a vCard, and you annotate it with the vCard mappings, then boom, you can see one of these. These are kind of display-oriented things. You can imagine wildly different things along the same lines. Like, for example, I don't have a lot of time, so let me just hit that very quickly. You can imagine frameworks that help you build applications faster by knowing this thing. Imagine a control that if you feed it a regular OData feed, then it displays kind of some default behavior. But if you actually feed it a bunch of description information, then it augments not just its display, but its behavior to do interesting things. And again, this would be an agreement between the control and the author of the annotations. Like, for example, in this case, let me switch real quick to Visual Studio. Not this one, but this one. I have a bunch of annotations here, and I mostly commented them all out. But if I uncomment some of them, let me just get a few of these going, and go back to the phone application and refresh. So what I'm doing is I'm not changing the application at all. I'm just refreshing the metadata. And in this case, there is a control that, based on the annotations, creates more entries in my list, for example. Or there is a control that, based on the annotations, displays things more interestingly inside, or maybe different display forms, like, you know, this calendar view or so on. So it's you can augment the meaning of the metadata items, which means from there you can change your behavior, the way you display things, and so on. Switch back to the presentation. So we think we call this like shared vocabularies, and we think this is a way of introducing vocabularies that will be shared sometimes between very few of you, sometimes between everybody. And sometimes you can actually reuse existing vocabularies. There is things like doubling core or good relations, existing ontologies out there that you know, are already defined and they're well understood. I think I'm really excited about this. I think there's a lot of opportunity here to extend the protocol in very rich ways without waiting for the core protocol to move forward. You can do this today, and you can do it yourself. You don't have to wait for everybody that works on OData to agree on something. And then if you happen to hit the spot on a particular kind of vocabulary, then maybe everybody picks it up and everybody uses it, and now you can count on that vocabulary being very common everywhere. So wrapping up, of course, this wouldn't be a talk on roadmap if I didn't talk about timelines. Again, this is kind of a loose timeline because the discussions and the protocols are not entirely controlled by us, they're controlled by the community at large. But pretty much everything we discussed today, we think in the next few months we'll be able to settle and feed into the protocol specs and then have the final discussions to give polish to the whole thing. There's a few more I didn't mention. In particular, I didn't mention containment, which is the ability to have trees inside rows, very popular among some folks. And I'm sure something else will come up and we'll have a discussion about whether or not we should do it this round or maybe leave it for a future version, or if we can do it through extensibility. I would love to see more and more of these things being built through the extensibility mechanisms. For .NET, this is, it's kind of early to tell, but I think, early next year, assuming that we land the list of features that we think and the scope is reasonable, then we think early next year we'll have an implementation for .NET. And of course, as usual, we'll have early builds as we make progress. Like for example, today we're shipping the bits that have an experimental version of the Delta links already built in. So with that, for all things OData, httpodata.org is the place to go. It should be your starting place for most of these. There's a few resources here for the OData site, the MSDN site, and my email and Twitter information if you want to contact me. There's a couple more talks today on JavaScript and data in general, and one on OData and how to build servers and stuff like that that should be pretty interesting. And with that, I want to thank you very much for staying here today, and I will take a few questions. Thanks.